Hey, Buttheads, welcome back to... Oh, he's interrupting me already. Let's try it again.
Get in there. Get in there.
Hey, Buttheads, welcome back to Bob Zemeckis is Not a Butthead. I am Richard.
And I'm Kyle.
Sorry, I usually introduce you. I got him right in the middle of a big swig of Topo Chico. Sorry, Kyle. How you doing?
How's it going? I'm doing good, man. I'm doing good. It's been a minute as life has gotten a bit busy, but we're back on it. We drafted too long off that rockin' Back to the Future episode, but now we're back with an even better episode for Roger Rabbit. We had to take it up a notch, Richard.
I agree.
That last one was so good, so insightful about Back to the Future. We had to take it up a notch. So you'll see, we have some surprises in store for everyone that we're going to make not surprises here in a second and tell you what they are. But it's going to be a more robust episode, a more dynamic episode. With more personnel involved.
More personnel. That's right. We have a composer friend, Brian Satterwhite, who's kind of a film music historian, who we have. We had a conversation about Roger Rabbit and the score. Brian's going to come on and talk about a whole bunch of stuff. It's going to turn into a Silvestri love fest a little bit, but we'll kind of get into it and bring him on in a little later.
Yeah, absolutely. And so super excited about all of that. Richard, we get to talk about Roger Rabbit today.
I didn't realize how much I love this movie until I rewatched it. I think this, at this point in the podcast and watching all the stuff we have and thinking about what's to come, I think this is his masterpiece, dude.
Oh, I mean, yeah. I mean, you know, well, I mean, it's tough. That's a tough call between Back to the Future and this, but certainly it is his biggest opus. I mean, in terms of just, I think we stumbled at some point across the fact that at the time it had the longest end credits of any movie ever, which makes sense considering it's a full live, you know, live action film and animated film. And the two things are superimposed just through fucking sheer effort and ingenuity.
Brute force.
The two things are no computers, just fucking they make
bunch
it happen
with
drawn on shit at the right angle. Like, what would that look like? And then they just draw it, and that's how they had to do the whole thing. So, yes, this is his most movie. So is it his greatest? Maybe, you know, maybe it's his greatest, but you know, there's some debate there, but it is his most movie. So
it's the most Zemeckis maybe, I think, for sure. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I came across when they got the green light and he was all set to go, apparently he called Richard Williams, who's the animator on the thing, and he called him and he was like, I was born to make this movie. This is the movie I was born to make this. It's mine. And I think that reads completely throughout the entire entire film. And to kind of like the big thing when we talk about Zemeckis, well, not you and I, but when everybody else talks about Zemeckis, it's all about the special effects. And this is kind of where that kind of chain starts in a big, big, big way. Because it wasn't just the hand-drawn stuff. There was a whole bunch of ILM work to figure out like focus and how light diffuses through the animation stuff. And it won an Oscar for that, deservedly. But I think this is kind of where that, looking back and stepping back for a second about his filmography on the whole, it's like, I think this has to be the point where that narrative starts. Like, it all comes back to this one leading into Zemeckis being the big visual effects
Where you're putting on Front Street the idea of like, look what we can do. We can make this thing and this thing coexist on screen. Check it out. And which would be a thread that would go through Forrest Gump and a whole bunch of other movies after that. But I think that potentially, yes, I agree. Maybe that view of him as a mechanist begins here. But, oh man, the film that's kind of where it ends though, because it as much as is going on, it certainly has a lot more. It cannot be accused of having like a lack of substance or thought with regard to the content of the film, which, if anything, is everything from the script to its incredibly robust execution and all of the weird and the fact that it's just fucking Chinatown, which is weird, which we got to talk about, and all the way down to the score. It is a rather robustly integrated work, in addition to, yes, it is a technical marvel at the same time. And I don't know. So yeah, there's a lot to talk about. Where do we start, Richard? Tell me you wrote something down, because there's just too much. We can't wing it through. These people paid for this podcast, $9.99 from what I understand.
I've not seen any of those checks.
Bring the heat, Richard, right now.
I think starting with the book. I read the book that it's based on. Who Censored
you
Roger?
You read the book.
I read the
That's
book.
That's what these people are paying for. See? That's what you I people did. Are paying for. That's Deep. Why you paid your $9.99 for this podcast, is that Richard took the time to read the book so you don't have to.
I don't think you have to. It's called Who Censored Roger Rabbit? Gary Wolf, Early 80s. It's less cartoons and more about like the Sunday funnies, like they're mm-hmm. photographers taking pictures of the tunes. Baby Herman's in there, Eddie Valiant, Roger Rabbit, Jessica Rabbit, and that's about where the similarities end. Mm-hmm. The line, I got a 50-year-old less than a 3-year-old dinky comes from the book. I'm not mm-hmm. bad, I'm just drawn that way comes from the book, but that's about mm-hmm. That's about it. In the book, it's more like a Maltese Falcon thing. Roger Rabbit is killed early in the movie, and his doppelganger joins with Eddie Valiant to solve his murder. Turns out Roger ends up being a murderer. There's a genie that comes out of a lamp that can make toons humans.
Nice.
It's very strange, but Disney recognizing
voiced
the potential.
Voiced by Robin Williams.
Yes.
in the book.
Oh, man, Aladdin. Reference. Wow, that took me a second. voiced by Will Smith now.
Yeah, so you go. Perfect.
Disney saw the potential for it, jumped on it, bought the book, and was pursuing
it. And this was in the early 80s. This was in the early 80s.
Yeah.
It was multiple iterations of trying to get the movie made. So they were getting jiggy correct. With it all the way back in 1983.
81.
Or something like, yeah. And I actually, I learned a fact about this movie. I'm really impressed.
I'll give you this space for it.
It could count as two facts, maybe even three.
But when they shot the initial tests
for Roger Rabbit to try and get it made, which apparently they couldn't get, you know, still couldn't get traction in the 80s. The little test, which is basically like a noir silhouette guy walking down an alley with Roger Rabbit, that Eddie Valiant, the detective, was played by Joe Pantoliano, and Roger Rabbit was voiced by Paul Rubens.
Yes.
And I don't know if that fact is true. You know, I didn't exhaustively research this fact, but
yeah,
I like that.
Yeah, it's there, and it's all one big shot. That was like the technical test that they Zemeckis and Williams put together to sell the idea that this could mm-hmm. could work, which is why you see the big camera movement, you see him knocking over garbage cans, the camera passes in front of a pane of glass so you can see how the animation is going to be affected when the camera is mm-hmm. looking through something at them, and it's super successful. Like, it's available on YouTube, you can go watch it. But yeah, it's crazy. Apparently once they shot that and sent it up, that's what got them the green light to go do everything. Mm-hmm. Go do the thing, because everybody's like, is there somebody in a suit like that's knocking mm-hmm. this stuff over? It was like nobody knew how they did it, which is kind of speaks to then expanded that to obviously the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
But Disney jumps on this thing. They were pursuing a more straightforward adaptation. That little test is actually closer to what is in the book. Zemeckis came on and said, well, we have to make the Chinatown stuff work. We have to make it an actual film noir piece, and that stuff has to read. We can't just play flippantly with it, which is, I think, why you get it functions really well as its mm-hmm. own noir thing. It's very, like you said, Chinatown-esque. Mm-hmm. And then they also
even straight down to how obviously similar the plots are, but I even was trying to kind of refresh before we were recording today. I was looking at, apparently, yeah, it's like even based on a proposed sequel for Chinatown, mm-hmm. which is going to be called Cloverleaf, and that's the name of Judge Doom's company and all of that. So and of course that seems arbitrary. We kind of get into it a little bit with Brian, who talks about the fusing of the two scores, the two styles, the noir score and then the classic animation score styles that Alan Silvestri pulls off in the movie. Is like that it seems like this arbitrary two things being stuck together. It's Chinatown, it's, you know, cartoons, and yet you know, what is Chinatown about other than Hollywood, Los Angeles having some sort of dark underbelly, some other side to it, some innate kind of corruption inside of it. And to then kind of utilize to utilize the kind of the showbiz idea of Hollywood, we have for cartoons, a surrogate for that kind of spiritual world, and to tell about that same kind of dark underbelly. Anyway, continuing, we'll get to that in a moment, and especially a bunch with Brian. But it's just such an interesting. How much of that, and this is a question now that you read the book that I can answer. Like, how much of that awareness is at all present in the book, or is it instead the book? Like, the book is based on comic book serial, like mm-hmm. cartoon characters, and it's based on just more of a generic noir plot, or that this all really arrives at the screenplay level with the film, doesn't it?
Right. It's for the most part the novel. I guess it's less. It's kind of like Raymond Chandler in the sense that it's set in L.A., and so you have some of the backdoor dealings. Like, you have an R.K. Maroon type character too in mm-hmm. the novel, but it's not an LA story, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Like, with the mm-hmm. whole billboards as far as the eye can see and the taking over the red car, that's very much a there's no really analog to that in the book that I recall. So that's kind of very, like you were saying, pulled from, it's basically Chinatown 3. That was something that they cooked up on the screenplay level.
Rad.
In an effort to make it feel more like a legit noir, yes. Which was very, 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 very successful. And I think that's one thing I wanted. I kind of, on reflection on the movie, you kind of hit on it. It's a successful noir, and it's also Sunday morning or Saturday morning cartoons. Mm-hmm. And bringing it back to Zemeckis for a second, this is his first, I feel, his first really big tonal swing. Mm-hmm. which is one of the reasons why I wanted to dive into all of his stuff, because looking at like The Walk is mm-hmm. such a strange movie. I know you haven't seen it, but some of his later mm-hmm. stuff, when I was watching it a few years ago, I was like, man, this guy like doesn't care. Like, he's just swinging for the fences literally every time. And mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think Back to the Future with the whole mother-son incest teenage plot, there's a bit of that, but this one where he's combining the noir feel and the Sunday morning cartoons is like, it's like straight down the middle. It's perfect, and it doesn't seem like it should work, but it does.
Yeah. Well, it's the kind of thing that, it's the kind of idea that as described seems like it works conceptually, but it's the kind of thing that it would be such a huge, to use your term, it would be such a huge swing. You would have to really you would have to thread a lot of very difficult needles to pull the whole thing off. You know, you would have to thread a lot of difficult needles. Both on, I mean, on, to start even with Eddie Valiant, you know, to start with that kind of a character, can you, and the film endeavors to do this, and I think succeeds in doing this, can you actually build a troubled noir protagonist who has, again, a crisis of faith within him? You know, he has a remembered past where he used to believe in good things that, of course, has been crushed out of him by the world. The death of his brother, literally killed by a tune. But he has within him this lineage of optimism, this lineage of literally his dad as a clown. Now, you'd say those things, and like, that's a fun idea. That's a fun, like, especially with, I mean, within this world, that's a really fun idea. But then that's a hard thing to pull off. And yet, in something as simple as that one shot that pulls around his desk and slowly, just in music and pictures, and by pictures, it just moves across the different
literal
shots
pictures.
Of his desk, him, yes, literal pictures in frames of him, his brother, their history with their clown father, then him being killed, and now he's absent, and all of that, and then back to him, and then it's the morning, and he's asleep on the desk, and it's like, not only does it pull it off, but it pulls it off with a kind of boldness and bravado and a kind of show-offiness that we see, again, on a lot of his other movies that we see in Back to the Future. It does it, you know, with a... And I think it's something that's throughout the entire film, is that the confidence becomes the style. It's like mm-hmm. his confidence in being able to pull this off becomes becomes the style. The show-offiness of it becomes a style because he sort of knows he's going to be able to generate that amount of empathy for this guy and then bring you back to the laughs a moment later. And that's what's really kind of, I don't know, that's what's just marvelous about the movie.
And you, just that shot in particular, because I was struck by that rewatching it too. How does that shot end? Obviously, we are back into the morning, but it ends with a trash can coming up and a bottle of Jack Daniels being thrown into it. So even within that shot, you get his full pass, what happens with his brother, and it ends with the punctuation of he's now a drunk.
Does the whole thing.
The whole thing. and the opening shot is worth kind of touching on too, because you have very similar elements in that, just with a walking, talking cartoon rabbit pulling on the jacket of the director and pulling back from, like, setting up the entire world of the film in one shot with Roger trying to plead for another take and not getting his way. You have the first interaction of the coat, which feels so subtle because Roger feels so real at that moment that it took me rewatching it twice to be like, damn, that's a really good effect that I never gave any appreciation to. And of course, that whole scene pulls back to Eddie slugging back a flask and scoffing tunes.
Yes. No, that's it's great. And I dig that, like, what the tunes are kind of coded to represent, what they very clearly represent after those scenes, is just something that I feel it's what the tunes represent to Zemeckis, what the tunes represent to him clearly in his other movies. Because I mean, like the there's a lot of Chuck Jones in I Want to Hold Your Hand. You know, he says, you know, that was his principal influences for Frank Capra and Warner Brothers cartoons. Okay. Cool. So clearly check. That, and he's trying to check. Got it. No, felt. So then you can see that, you know, that is what, you know, these Warner Brothers cartoons, that is what, that is what it means to Zemeckis. And you see that thread in Eddie Valiant's character. Again, it's something you can feel a lot more when, like we were saying, when you kind of watch the movies in sequence, you can begin to see that, that Chuck Jones, that sort of buoyant joy of just being able to, like, drop refrigerators on people's heads or dump people out of the sides of cars or send people over waterfalls and all that fun shit that he's playing with is, you know, that is his heart song. That is why he's making the movies. And it was nearly crushed out of him. And we know from his filmography that again and again, he was given several very, you know, big chances that for reasons that are kind of outside of his control, he delivered the goods, and yet the movies did not connect commercially and all of that. So we see in that shot of Eddie Valiant's career of, like, originally going to clown school and they were the fun cops and he's wearing a clown nose and then the world fucking crushed it out of him and he had to make Romancing the Stone, you know, and fucking not put as much insanity in it, and everyone keeps firing him off of shit and it was almost gone and you see that all there. But then he comes back and he makes Back to the Future. And what happens? He starts bouncing around on a pogo stick and singing, you know, and we'll get to that. That's at the end of the movie. But it's a thread. It's a nice thread where you see that faith, that love of movies, the joy of movies that Zemeckis is trying to keep alive in his movies while still trying to make grown-up movies for grown-up people. Is what the cartoons are in this. And when you kind of see that in sequence and you watch it, it's just a very dope way to appreciate this movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
And dig it, man.
One of the things that, again, on reflection, and again, you and I talked about this before. This one was hard to kind of suss the pieces out because we are so close to it. Like, I didn't
know. I know,
yeah. It's hard.
Like, you can't see the forest for the trees, just in the sense that, like, I did. This is one that, and it's a fact worth noting, that maybe even more so than Back to the Future, I would just obsessively watch on VHS when I was a kid. I don't really even properly, you know, I mean, I was born in 85, so I don't properly remember a time of not fully having, at least being aware or having seen this movie. And so a lot of things are very, I just take for granted. I was, in other words, I was more aware of this plot as the plot of Roger Rabbit before, long before I was aware of it in any way as the being the plot of Chinatown. Right. So that is my experience of this movie, and eventually had to sort of work everything out backwards in the intervening years.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that I noticed this time, and again, it took like rewatching it two or three times and then sitting and trying to think really hard about it. And it's the way the cartoons are. It's not just the technical piece of how the cartoons are integrated, but mm-hmm. how the characters, the types of interactions that they have mm-hmm. throughout the movie. It's not like Mary Poppins where they're just floating around and it's this joyous thing all the time. Mm-hmm. Like the first time we see Roger, he's desperate. He can't mm-hmm. get it right. He needs another chance. And then it's sexy at the Ink and Paint mm-hmm. Club. It's very sexy at the Ink and Paint Club. Like that's burned from like young me watching it. You get frustration with Roger seeing those photos. Mm-hmm. It's tense with Judge Doom and the weasels and the killing of that shoe. It's very dark. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And surprisingly dark with the killing of the shoe. Every time it's like you kind of think, well, I'm an adult now, and then so I'll have some perspective on why they went that dark, and you're like, and still at this point I'm like, that's pretty fucking dark to have gone in the movie with the shoe, who apparently was voiced by Nancy Cartwright, Bart Simpson.
It's crazy fact. But I think that it's not just that there's the cartoons in there, it's the way they're used and the depth of the story that they are given themselves. We have Roger Rabbit like getting tearful and crying in the movie theater with the scene with Bob Hoskins, like reliving mm-hmm. that moment. We have an action sequence with Benny, mm-hmm. The cab, which thinking back to Zemeckis and his stunts, like there's car stunts in there. He's the car stunt guy.
He is. And he had to put an animated car in there.
I love Benny so much. but I think there's something to the way the tunes are implemented and used within the story that provides mm-hmm. it this that gets that depth that makes it read as this real film noir thing that can then jump to crazy cartoon antics as it does like every scene.
Yeah. Well, that's cool that the film doesn't. It also has to. To say the film is a balancing act is kind of a grotesque understatement, but what I like is broadly across the film as the character begins in this dark, cynical place and eventually moves back towards sort of finding the light, finding hope again, you know, finding that inner clown within him. The movie does get to go from a lot of noirish darkness, the film getting to pull off the trick of making the cartoons occupy a world that feels very, very grounded. And in that way, leaning into that darkness and leaning into that noirishness helps with that. You know, it feels very material and very grounded. So you're like, holy shit, there's a fucking rat in the room, you know? And so it plays to its advantage. And then as the film kind of transits into light over the course of the whole breadth of it, then the cartoon in the whole thing inverts. And by the end of it, we have Eddie Valiant literally occupying a cartoon world and then eventually sort of being a cartoon himself. And of course, with all at that point is really fucking Looney Tunes and he's just bouncing around on bungee cords and all sorts of shit. But it allows them to, what it permits them to do is because they're saving all of that, because they have, the film is going to kind of ramp into that near the end. It allows them to sort of, I don't know, just to really dig in on characters that when I was a kid, I just fully bought and fully read as empathetic noirish characters. I don't know if it even struck me as odd. This is how young I was when I first saw this film. You know, that there was a rabbit there, which I take for granted now. It's like, I was a dumb kid. I just didn't realize what a technical feat it was. Roger Rabbit was there. But now I look at it differently. And I think that that's a testament just on, not just an aesthetic or technical level, but just in terms of how seriously all of the characters in their world were taken and setting up Eddie and all of that, that I just bought in. I was pulled in when I was a kid. And so I just took it very, very seriously. And now that's the thing I kind of marvel at is not that, oh shit, there's a rabbit drawn into the frame, but instead that like, no, there was a rabbit in the room and yet I still cared.
Right. I think that's such a like it's such, that's why I say maybe masterpiece, because usually with visual effects things like this, we're so used, especially these days, to watch a thing and be like, this is bad visual effects, that's visual effects, this isn't real. And with this movie, we mm-hmm. have to kind of go the opposite route and remind mm-hmm. ourselves that this is an effect, and we keep getting yeah. sucked into the characters and into the story, which it's a staggering achievement. And mm-hmm. I do want to talk about a little bit about how they did it. I don't know if you watched the doc on it, but mm-hmm. like they hired a whole bunch of puppeteers to hold all the stuff, and they had a whole mm-hmm. bunch of strings, but they also, it's silly, you have like weasels that are, you know, 2 feet high. They have mm-hmm. physical sculptures of the rabbit and the weasels that they would mm-hmm. always shoot a plate for, mm-hmm. reference for the animators. So you have these like just weird action figures that don't move at all, that they're Zemeckis is like carrying through the scene,
just like paper mache models exactly. of characters that they're like shaking at Bob Hoskins, and he's yeah. like, oh god,
and they're setting his eyeline too, so, and that's that I yeah. heard that in the behind the scenes stuff, and like for Hoskins to have that, his eyeline is like perfect throughout the movies, because it's yeah. not just he's looking into space, he's looking at an actual thing, an invisible mm-hmm. thing. But they have these dummies that they're doing reference for, and man, it just looks like,
I think they brought the dummies in probably for the takes, and then would pull yeah. them out, and he would have to remember where the eyeline was,
right?
You know, and stuff. But they actually, from what I understand, a lot of productions are even still doing that. I think I was just watching some. You know, I got pulled into watching some sort of silly special effects YouTube video about how some new HBO series, fantasy series with a lot of animal characters, it's the Golden Compass, you know, thing or whatever right. it is. I can't remember the title of that series. One of it, you know what it is. The polar bear one.
Yeah, the Golden Compass.
Yeah, that they're using puppets and stuff on sets, mm-hmm. that they literally have puppeteers and using like kind of, but like classier looking ones that look all right. wood, like they could be like on age at some artsy thing, instead of just like a paper mache weasel that Bob Hoskins is using to give Bob Zemeckis is using to give Bob Hoskins a heart attack. A lot of Bobs on this movie.
So many.
Yeah.
And they also had Charles Fleischer, who voiced Roger Rabbit. They had him on set too, mm-hmm. like off screen, screaming his lines
in a rabbit costume,
which is so funny. When they were shooting at the studio, he would go out for his lunch break, and so all of the other people on the lot would look over and see this guy dressed really shittily as a rabbit, and everybody was going like, "Ooh, this Roger Rabbit movie looks like it's gonna be terrible." But that's something he insisted on. He wanted to be the character, and for the most part, I don't think they used all of his stuff on set, but it definitely gave Hoskins something to. Mm-hmm. to work off of, because man, the task that Hoskins was given to act against an invisible cartoon, not just an invisible cartoon rabbit, but the cartoon femme fatale. And
yes, well, and that's one thing to do when you're being asked to like pogo around at the end, and you're like, I get it, it's a kid's movie. That's another thing when he's like, no, like fucking, like your brother's dead, take this seriously, by the way, this is where the rabbit's gonna be.
Right.
That's harder.
Get out of that chair.
Yes, exactly. Oh, yeah.
Where's your brother? He used to be. He seems like a sensitive and sober fellow. That's one of my favorite lines on rewatch, mm-hmm. which of course flew over my head as a kid. Well, yeah, watching it again, the amount of alcohol that is consumed throughout this movie is a lot.
Pretty great.
It's pretty great.
It was during that time when people, as we were beginning to arc toward the 1990s. And everyone thought that kid stuff couldn't be kid stuff, it needed to be a little bit more adult. It's like, how do we make Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse cool again? Let's put it adjacent to some guy drinking or something.
It worked. So,
and things, yeah, in this context, it definitely did. Then they went too far later on, but this is just the right amount. They should have stayed in this lane.
Yes.
I agree.
There's one more thing, I think, in terms of Zemeckis, thinking back through the rest of his movies before this, him being a bit of an anarchist, socially irresponsible, I think it ties directly into that.
His short films?
Yeah. Even A Field of Honor.
Field of Honor?
Yeah.
Field of Honor.
But the fact that there's so much drinking in this kid's film, it's staggering. And also, just thinking...
If anything, it's delightful because it speaks to the time in which the film, the film was made. And it's like, why do we live in this slightly neutered version of the world where films that are made with any kind of resources behind them have to kind of be present a kind of G-rated version of the world? And I mean that in even terms of, and I know it's easy to say that, like, well, what do you expect Pixar movies to have drinking? I don't mean Pixar movies, but popular entertainments, like, you know, even Marvel movies and that sort of thing, don't necessarily touch in these areas. Or I don't know. Anyway, so I just, it's fun. It's just interesting to examine the ways in which the film just intuitively feels it couldn't be today. And what does that say about now, Richard? Answer the question.
There was a different. We've come too clean. Things are too clean now.
That's like, right.
We're too. It's everything has to be politically correct. Everybody's afraid to do or say something.
Another thing I like about the movie, in terms of things being too clean, is that like a lot of like the objects that are being held by like the octopus bartender are just dangling around on strings.
Yeah.
Like we can see the octopus bartender dancing around. There's no strings, and that. It's bizarre to say, but even that level of tactile connection of like they have bottles and, you know, things dancing around up on strings. Yeah. Again, makes that world feel more grounded than most sky battles over cities I've seen in the last few years. So anyway, there you go.
And I think that goes to how much he pushed. Like he pushed really, really hard. He was coming off a big confidence booster from Back to the Future. But it's the same kind of
very high T at the moment, very high T.
Right. But it's the same. If you're looking back at like used cars or something, there's a lot of really ambitious stuff in that movie from a stunt perspective, and like really going for it. Like apparently when he got the job, Disney was like, oh, well, we've done Mary Poppins. We'll tell you how to do this. Here are the rules. Mm-hmm. You can't move the camera because it's too hard for animators to track camera movement. We have to stay away from light and shadows. Everything on the set has to be lit really evenly. They said this to him in a meeting, and he walked out and says, well, those are the rules we're going to break.
Perfect.
Which is how the movie is what it is, and also how the budget ballooned from $30 million to $70 million.
Mm-hmm.
But it made a lot of money when it was released. So,
no, I imagine that it also helps to have Steven Spielberg in your corner. Helps you get that money. Well, it helps you get Mickey Mouse and Bugs Bunny.
Correct. And I think in terms of just, you mentioned before about him used to having movies that worked but didn't find an audience. And he's got a history of test screenings going very, very, very well. I Want to Hold Your Hand tested well. Used Cars tested well. Back to the Future tested very well. This one tested very, very poorly, actually, because the effects.
So he's like, this could be a good sign.
The effects, it tested so poorly. Yeah. The effects weren't finished, and they showed it to a bunch of 19-year-olds, this movie with unfinished cartoon effects, and they were all bored and didn't get it. But Zemeckis had Final Cut. He stood up to Disney and was like, no, it's going to work. It's going to work. And sure enough, all of the test screenings.
That's another thing that was very different about that time. A director just having that.
Yeah.
You know, not just having that. He earned it, but still.
Right. And then because of this, like, if you look forward a bit, like he could do basically what he wanted for 20 years based on the strength of this. Because it made a bunch of money and was nominated for a bunch of Oscars, not just visual effects, but it won for editing, it won for sound design, it was nominated for cinematography, art direction, set direction. So very, not just commercially successful, but critically successful as well.
Nice. Well, Richard, what's next on your outline?
The only other thing that I wanted to talk about was just looking back at zooming out and thinking about Forrest Gump to come, like, and looking at what he's saying. You kind of picked up this thread in Back to the Future about like it's post World War II and what does it do to the families and manliness and how does it shape the family? You have elements of politics with the used cars, where the used cars dealer guy is wanting to go into politics. So it's kind of this really, I Want to Hold Your Hand as a obsession with media and fan culture. And this one, just thinking about the ending, which seems to end in this really wonderful rosy picture where the deed to Toontown is found, and the Toons get access to Toontown, and it's this wonderful, uplifting thing. Everybody wins. But thinking about it in the Chinatown way, sure, everybody wins in the movie, but this is the kind of thing that actually... It didn't go the way in real life. Yeah. Like his plan of billboards as far as the eye can see, yes, and freeways with on ramps and off ramps, that came true. And so the movie has this uplifting end. But all of the plot, that his evil plot that he screams out maniacally, is reality. So even looking at this film, which has this wonderful uplifting ending, if you just think about it for a second, his plot seems an awful lot like.
Yes, well, it's the kind reality. Of thing. Yes, I know, it's the kind of thing that we've talked about that's sort of just absent from any conversations about Zemeckis, because when people kind of talk about him as just a mechanist or a technician, and he certainly has a marvelous, you know, one of those, but it's just like that is a delightfully subversive undercurrent to the ending, is that you deliver a Disney movie where literally a giant room full of cartoons says, "We found the deed," and all jumps up and says, "Yay!" But we know the entire future is dependent upon something that a moment earlier in the film, the villain who laid out his plan, you know, is dependent upon that plan not coming to pass, but we all know that that plan ultimately comes to pass. So it, not unlike Chinatown, has that dark thread of, you know, portents about the future, all of that. And again, it's the kind of thing that, I don't know, it's just, it's a fun element. It definitely ties it in. What I like about it is, okay, what does it mean? What's the film trying to say? Why do that? Is it conscious of what it's trying to do? And if you look at I think in most people's estimation, look at Roger Rabbit as a popular entertainment by a very talented mechanist, they would say, I don't know, it's a screenplay, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, there's, when you look at it, it's another thing that you appreciate looking at it in sequence, is that you see the same voice, that same thread of that kind of, you know, boy who's trying to sneak curse words into his presentation in front of the class, you know, that kind of delightfully mischievous thing that is not only present in his films, but even like with his His Great Adventures episode and all of that. He
amazing stories,
his characters, yes, and it's a mischievous film, and so yes, and it has a mischievous ending. It has I don't know, so. Yeah, it's like, how else? What else do you do with Judge Doom's a speech about the freeway, other than sort of, anyway? Let's talk about Judge Doom, by the way. He's freaky,
so dark. And again, just pulling back from that, you have a judge who is systematically executing Toons, judge, jury, and executioner style, in the most gruesome way possible. Just executing this. The group of Toons. It's it's disgusting and scary.
Well, yeah, let's talk about. Really, so I'm trying not to tread on territory that I know we might go over with Brian later, but we'll just jump into some of that too. But it is funny seeing Judge Doom after having seen what is the name of this
Amazing Stories
episode. Just because another third Christopher Lloyd performance, another increasingly insane and increasingly malevolent. He was kind of ambiguously malevolent, you know, in Amazing Stories when he was Mr. Beans, Professor Beans.
Professor Beans.
Exactly. But in this one, I don't know. They have literally sculpted like pointy nose and chin onto him. Mm-hmm. He ultimately becomes something quite nightmare inducing. And the other thing is he's clearly, you know, he's evoking John Huston from Chinatown a bit. And it's like, it's interesting to view, like, what then, if we know kind of what these Toons represent for Bob Zemeckis, his love of movies, the thing that drew him like a moth to the flame to be chewed up by the system because Used Cars was not a hit or whatever, his love of movies is alive and it's sustaining, but it's almost been ground out of him. But not unlike Chinatown, not unlike many noirish films that end with sort of have a bleak undercurrent to their ending, that sort of that have a just sort of a pessimistic idea about where the world is headed. you know, this film has an innately pessimistic idea about where LA is headed, about where the entertainment industry is headed, about where America is headed. It has a very, very, very pessimistic idea about that. And yet, by delivering this ironic tonal ending where all of the characters jump up and say, yay, at the end, and it's buried more subtly, the film is in certain ways, and yes, Richard, I am about to say what I'm about to say, it's more similar to a film like Robert Altman's Player than it is, you know, some other kind of a delightful technical achievement from the time that I can't think of right now as a good counterexample. But, you know, with the Player obviously skewers Hollywood pretty hard, but then ends ironically by, of course, having a very, very, very flawed protagonist who has done some very, very, very bad things end up succeeding. Spoilers for the Player, I guess. See it.
I haven't seen it.
You should. It's really fucking good.
Spoilers. Spoilers have they've done science on this, and spoilers don't ruin somebody's enjoyment of the.
No, when I say spoilers, whatever. It's a movie. Like most movies I ever saw in my life, I came in that I love. I came in halfway through on TV, watched the back half first, right. And later on saw the first half after I'd seen the back half a million times. So that would be a great discussion to have, or movies where you saw the like act two and three,
and we're like, a million times
on TV, and then years later, you realize you had not seen the entire first act of the movie. I've had that experience dozens of times. What was I talking about a second ago?
The Player, how similar it is to the Player, the ending.
Oh yeah, the Player is a very smart movie, but it comes from Robert Altman, so we are very aware of what the film is trying to do, and we engage with it on that level, and so. But when you have, and this I really think is where it diverges, a cartoon rabbit in the room, people tend to fixate on that.
Right.
But I think, we've said in a bunch of we said about Back to the Future, I think it is this substance, it is this tension between the cartoony optimism and the weird pessimism in the freeway speech, the darkness of the alcoholism and and all of that mixed with the cartoony shit. It is that it's the furnace that heats the rest of the thing. Like you really would not give a shit about seeing a rabbit on screen after about 5 minutes if you were not increasingly invested in what that meant and what it meant for those characters.
Right.
And that dynamic tension that gives it a lot of internal space and a lot of internal life comes from the distance between those elements. Comes from like, but the freeway thing, but they're happy. Okay, cool. I guess it was a happy ending. Wait a minute. Like, that's what makes you chew on the movie a little bit more. And as a kid, return to it a little bit more. The fact that Jessica Rabbit is sexualized to the point where, as the animators, I think, said, she would just fall over if you actually were a real person.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, to the point where it's kind of grotesque is part of why you remember it. And by the way, Richard, you should see The Player. We're going to do a bonus episode where you see The Player, and then we're going to talk about and Chinatown. We're going to do that one too, and we'll watch them all, and we'll do another podcast.
Yes, let's keep going on
Chinatown.
Let's keep going on the Zemeckis thing, and then we can talk about what we're doing post
Zemeckis. We're going to figure out five additional podcasts on this episode of this podcast. One of them is just a one-off where we watch The Player and talk about it.
Okay, a one-off I can do.
There you go.
What do you think? Should we get Brian in here?
We should get Brian in here. I think he's been waiting in the green room long enough.
Wings.
I'm very excited. So yeah, and I'm sure we gave him a good intro on there, so we should just throw it. We know Brian for a long time, and he is the kind of the go-to guy right now. I think the go-to guy when you want to talk about film music. And I think just to tee up why having him on here is more than just talking about Alan Silvestri's score. I think that the score is one of the best concretizations of everything we talked about, of those weird, disparate, distant unities that the film manages to weirdly reconcile, you know, more so than having the rabbit occupy, or as much so as having the rabbit occupy the same space as Bob Hoskins, both visually and emotionally. There is music that threads that same line back and forth violently and then synthesizes them. And that's just a great springboard to talk about why this movie's so cool, and it's rad to talk with Brian because he's a cool guy. knows a lot about movies too. So
yeah, yeah, like, I think that's the big thing with Brian. He's not just a composer; he's a filmmaker too. That's how he looks at what he does composing and how he looks at film music. It's part of the whole process. It's not just music; it's how it tells the story.
So, and which one of his knockoff, delightful knockoff Alan Silvestri pieces are we going to be? Should we segue with? Is it? Are we going to segue with some Forrest Gump piano? What are we going to do?
I think we should do the Forrest Gump thing. Give it some pedestal time.
Well, cool. Well, then I'm excited to hear from Brian.
Same. Play that piano music.
Roll that beautiful bean footage.
Say hi, Brian.
Hey, everybody. How you doing?
This is Brian Satterwhite. We've known Brian for about 10 years. Brian is a smart guy. He knows everything there is to know about film music. He hosts a radio show about film music. He scores films. Brian, how would you describe yourself in relationship to the wonderful world of film music?
That's a good start. I like to say that I preach the gospel of film music any chance I get, whether it's composing my own score, which is my primary job, writing about film music, interviewing other composers, doing lectures, teaching, radio shows, you name it. I'm out there just preaching the gospel, trying to elevate the art form of film music any way I can.
Rad. And when we were introducing you last time as a little tease that you were going to be on for this episode, we brought up the fact that you you participated in that, I guess what ended up being the final Every Frame a Painting, right? You kind of worked on that. How did that come about? I've never talked to you about that directly. But that was rad, by the way, because having talked to you about film music for years, I felt you all over that video, that Marvel film score video or whatever it was. It was really, if you haven't checked it out, it's please do watch it. It's rad.
Yeah, it's called a Marvel Symphonic Universe, I guess is what the title of the little short was. Well, I was just working in my studio one day, and I get an email from Tony, and he was explaining to me that he has this channel on YouTube. And again, when Tony reached out to me, I had never heard of Every Frame of Painting. I'd never heard of Tony. This was all completely brand new to me. And he said, you wrote an article online being fairly critical of Marvel films. Basically, my position is I love the Marvel movies. I really honestly do. But the film music is really lacking. It's like they're great films that don't have great scores. And I wrote fairly in detail of why that is. And he had been thinking that himself. And he said, hey, I want you to kind of bring you on as a kind of a co-writer to help me flesh out my ideas and explain what is it about Marvel scores? Why are they not working? What is good about them? And so he interviewed me two different times, probably a total of about 3 hours total, just asking me questions and interviewing me. And then he went off and made the video based off a lot of the things that I was talking about. And you're right. I had the same response when I saw the video. It was like, even though he did it all, it was like experiencing my philosophy pouring out of this video that somebody else made. He did a very good job. And again, I had never heard of Every Frame of Painting. So that he said, he called me up and he said, it's going to post tomorrow. And I was like, okay, great. You know, I was just thinking just something small that's going to go out in the world. And the next
I will email this to people I know. And I'm like, look, it's a fun video.
Yeah. I totally thought that's all it was. Well, the next day when it hit my texting and Facebook, and it just started blowing up, and I had no idea why. I was like, what the heck is this? And I realized, okay, the video hit. Every Frame of Painting is kind of a big deal. and apparently, millions of people are watching it. And it was like totally mind blowing. But I'm real, real proud of being a part of that. I think he did a fantastic job. And I'm glad it's there for posterity.
Rad. As we all are. And I think it was viewed like a few million times. And I think I've gone back and watched it a couple of times because it feels like one of your articles. Or just one of your just listening to you talk about film music sort of come alive with lots of sounds and pictures and colors is pretty sweet. But we're not here to talk about that. Richard, what are we here to talk about today?
Well, we're here to talk about Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
God damn right.
It's, yes, so amazing. And the reason we brought Brian on is Brian, of course, did the music that intros and outros the show. And we were like, Brian, we want to have guests on. We want to have you come on and talk about the score. What movie do you want to come on and do? And your first answer, I believe, was Roger Rabbit. So that's why Brian's on. And
yes, Brian, why did you pick Roger Rabbit?
I mean, you have to understand that it's a tough decision, because when you're talking about Zemeckis, you're going to talk about Alan Silvestri. Yes. They are hand in glove. They are the reasons, I believe, for each other's success. I don't think Silvestri would have been the composer he is today without Zemeckis, and vice versa. And everybody, when you think about the pair, you think about the big scores. You know, you think about Back to the Futures, which are all incredible scores. You might think about Forrest Gump. I mean, there's some big scores out there, but not a lot of people might really think about Who Framed Roger Rabbit when it comes to film music. And to me, what Silvestri did on Roger Rabbit is a real clinic for all film music enthusiasts. There are so many different styles and different flavors and different homages and different. And I, when I listen to that score, I get goosebumps, and it makes me go like, gosh, how did he do all that? How did he manage and wrangle all of those different flavors and styles and genres into one score? Whereas Back to the Future, it's a 5-star score. Yeah. It is what it is. It's just a rousing adventure score. But Roger Rabbit just has so many different layers to it.
Yes, so many disparate influences that have to be reconciled that are as disparate as seeing a cartoon rabbit standing next to Bob Hoskins. It's like musically you have to reconcile similar things. Well, it's right there. I mean, to kind of jump into it a little bit, and that's definitely why we had you on, Brian, was, I mean, to talk about Alan Silvestri, we want to like throw lots of positive energy. We know this man has moved us. We know that he has created all of these iconic scores, and yet we feel utterly inept in our ability to actually talk about how great he is. But it's right there in those first few seconds of Roger Rabbit where you see the title emerge from darkness in this very noirish way, and you have this very evocative noirish music. And then on a dime, it becomes, you know, merry melodies, you know, and it just becomes this cartoon score seconds later. And that contrast and then the eventual kind of reconciliation between those two ideas throughout the whole film and how far apart they seem kind of is what the whole movie is. And I don't know, it's just right there in those first few seconds. So that's what I picked up on, just knowing that you were going to be on, Brian. I had to pay attention to the music. And it lasted only the first 10 seconds, and then I forgot about the task.
Well, and it's that style specifically that really impresses me. When you think about cartoon music, you know exactly what that sounds like, right? Mm-hmm. All the little blurps and blips and blops and quick, you know, film music for cartoons, or cartoon music changes on a dime so much. And that was basically invented by a man named Carl Stalling back in the 1930s. He originally worked for Walt Disney. If you go back to Walt Disney's earliest, and I mean earliest short films, the music behind them all was primarily done by Carl Stalling. And then Warner Brothers Studios, when they started doing Bugs Bunny and doing all the Looney Tunes, hired Stalling away from Disney. And that's where what we now understand as being cartoon music was born. And he invented this whole style, this whole sound of music that doesn't exist anywhere else but cartoons.
Like, and just to get into the nitty gritty of that, what is that cartoon music? It's like, it's xylophones. It's weird shit. It's bridging that area, that land between music, between music and sound effects. And it's, I mean, like what are we hearing when we, cause it's so easily identifiable to us. And how is Alan Silvestri replicating that? I'm just kind of curious, what is going on there?
And you hit the nail on the head. I mean, sound effects, for a short cartoon, very, very difficult to do. If you can have your composer come in and do music that can take away 45 to maybe 60% of the sound effect responsibility, that just makes the whole process easier for everybody, except maybe the composer, because that style of composing is so impressive to me, and it's hard to do. A lot of composers have tried to replicate that style, and I think some have gotten close, and there have been some fairly good representative examples, but none that I can think of, like what Silvestri did for the opening, you know, cartoon from Roger Rabbit. Yeah. And it's that idea that basically it's called Mickey Mousing is the term that is used to describe this. And it's called Mickey Mousing, again, going back to Carl Stalling and Walt Disney, where you use music to accent not just a lot of the action, but all of the action. If there is something moving on screen, if an arm raises up, if a head lowers down, there is a musical note or an instrument or something to capture it sonically. And when you have that degree of concentration, it becomes this very, very acrobatic, functional beast. And if you watch an action film and the music is scoring tightly with the action, let's say like Raiders of the Lost Ark, The Basket Game.
I was literally about to say, is this kind of like the basket chase when everything gets Chuck Jonesy? And she's like, I got a knife. I got a bigger knife. Literally, these are the images in my head while you're talking about this.
That's a great example. I don't know if I would call that Mickey Mousing per se. I would call it scoring tightly to the action. But to take it to Mickey Mousing, you have to go 5-6 steps even further. You can't just have, you know, let's say in the basket game, there's not hardly three measures that go by where Williams isn't accenting something. Well, for Carl Stalling, you can't let one beat of music go by with accenting. It's that tightly packed into the framework of the visuals. And it's so difficult to do. The man invented it. He perfected it. There's been some other Scott Bradley did a really great job. You know, he's famous for the Tom and Jerry cartoons. He followed in Carl Stalling's wake. Hoyt Curtin, who did a lot of the Hanna-Barbera cartoons. Again, there have been some composers to follow in that wake, but it's so difficult. And I've heard some composers try to do it, get close, but not quite. I don't even know. I've never had the opportunity. I would love to try, but it would be probably the scariest thing I would ever have to do is that kind of early cartoon Mickey Mouse.
Yeah. Well, Will, I'm sure, because Bob Zemeckis, I'm sure, is listening to this right now, I demand Bob Zemeckis, we must make Roger Rabbit 2 and throw Brian at this problem immediately. So we, with Roger Rabbit, we have him coming hot off the success of Back to the Future, and we have Zemeckis sort of living into the influences he's talked about the whole time, his biggest influences being Frank Capra and Warner Brothers cartoons. We certainly see that kind of Chuck Jonesy, Warner Brothers stuff all over I Want to Hold Your Hand and all over Used Cars and his other work. And now we finally have him. He's found the perfect project, the perfect conduit in which to engage with all of this stuff directly. And it really, kind of watching it with like adult eyes now, it's amazing how much it just is, or it really seems like the goal was just to make Chinatown, but with cartoons. And that was sort of the joke of the whole thing. Because the plot is eerily similar to Chinatown. It's all about old Hollywood. Even Judge Doom, you know, played by Doc Brown himself, Christopher Lloyd, strongly to me now evokes John Huston. I don't know if anyone else got this, but he almost kind of has a John Huston equality to him, you know, not unlike in Chinatown. But anyway, but it's such a bizarre idea that they attacked so hard and had so much money with which to do it.
Right. And I think it's not just the fact that it's this bizarre idea, but the way he decided to approach it tonally as a Chinatown. So the performances are all living. It has that look, and then the performances have that feel, like Zemeckis was saying on I Want to Hold Your Hand. The jokes aren't, the characters aren't saying jokes. The characters are interacting in their real world, and then the audience is framing them as jokes, which I think is part of what makes the movie kind of balanced. Like, it takes the noir stuff really seriously. He actually said to the screenwriters, guys, this has to function as a film noir movie. It can't be just cartoons. We've seen that before. The movie has to stand on its own.
Which is what's funny about watching it on Disney Plus is, like, he is an alcoholic. People die. Yeah. It's like the noirish parts are they hit a little hard, you know. They hit a little hard for the Disney Plus audience. And that's what I think makes the film feel so dynamic, is the contrast between that and fucking cartoons, man. Lots of them. Everywhere.
And can you imagine? You imagine? Because this is the thing about Roger Rabbit that appeals to me from the composer's point of view. It's that, again, you touched on that diametrically opposed tonal entities existing together. You have this bright, colorful cartoons that are wacky, zany, everything, and turned up. I mean, they took the wackiest Looney Tunes, Warner Brothers short, and dialed it up to, you know, even more.
It became itchy and scratchy.
Exactly.
And then, go ahead.
And then you have, on the other side, you have the film noir aspect of it too. Now, from a composer's point of view, can you imagine this film, first of all, with no music right now? I mean, almost like you're watching, you're the composer, you get this film, and you are watching it, and you're like, holy hell, like, what what the hell am I supposed to do with this? I mean,
yes. Now it's like Bob Zemeckis put Bob Hoskins and a rabbit on screen. He's like, I need you to give this a soul that makes sense. Fuck you, you figure it out.
Yeah. I mean, that has got to be just this massive Herculean effort to try to like, because there's so much going on. And then how do you do that? And every time I'm evaluating a film score, I try to think about that. Like, what's going through the composer's mind when they see it for the first time and it's their job to give it that musical tone? Most of the time, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, again, as great as Raiders of the Lost Ark is, the tone of that is relatively straightforward. It's a grand adventure. So, okay, let's compose a grand adventure score. But when you're doing, again, Carl Stalling and, you know, everything black and white film noir.
It also feels like it pulls from. Feels like it pulls from Chinatown. I watched the opening bits of Chinatown, and the score sound. He's definitely pulling from that too, at least to my untrained.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, all that stuff. Well, and to talk about those influences, I mean, it's kind of interesting because to get into a little bit of the plot of Roger Rabbit, Bob Hoskins is obviously this, you know, private investigator. He worked for Valiant and Valiant. Of course, the other Valiant being his brother, who was killed, as we learned, because a tune dropped a piano on his head, which is revealed. Which has both a tremendous, to talk about reconciling disparate tones, a dramatic import. It's very tragic and yet is hilarious when revealed, and yet all of the tragedy that surrounds him is, you know, for the film noir aspect of the film, is very, very real. Now, what's interesting is that the reconciliation, and maybe this is reflected in the score as well, but the reconciliation of those two things is literally made the kind of internal subtext of Bob Hoskins' character, like in that brilliant shot where you get a window into his world later on, where where it goes from day to night, you know, or whatever, or from night to day, sorry, going across all those wonderful photos, and a shot similar to the one at the beginning of Back to the Future, where you learn that his literal backstory, in addition to having a dead brother, was a dad who was a clown in the Ringling Brothers Circus. So it's like he has this, and that he and his brother were big hams when they first joined the force. You see him in their photo with their clown noses on. And so you realize that he has a kind of, like many things in Robert Zemeckis movies, has had a kind of loss of faith. He's kind of had a loss of this internal thing, which is represented by clowning and joy and being tune and loving Toontown. And so, you know, we see that kind of fallen world, similar to the fallen world we see in Back to the Future, this kind of noirish world where literally he has to have the inner tune kind of restored within him. And he even uses literally that, like the tools of his clown father, but we'll get to that later on, to vanquish the bad guys in the end. And I don't know, and in that way, you kind of draw, and that's why it's great having Brian here for this, is you see this kind of really broad, like really cool integration from score to concept to character of what tunes and what that sound and what those images represent, and what noir and what the Chinatown aspects and what that represents. And the entire film is about kind of restoring one into the other. And it's, I don't know, it just makes for a really rad type of movies. So,
and I think, but moment you mentioned where we learn the piano was dropped on his head, I love her performance in that shot, as you have her saying, a tune killed his brother, dropped a piano on his head, but it's said with such conviction that you understand the pathos in the next scene. But as an adult watching it, you're like, Jesus Christ, that's funny. Like, we've laughed at that.
It's funny.
We've laughed at that.
It's beautiful. And just because I want to note it, and you then have him, you know, and as usual, Zemeckis, with clearly a lot of money around, he was able to further emphasize that. She walks out from behind the bar, just so you get that row of guys' heads behind her. Just like, it's very John Ford. It's like a Western scene. So she says, dropped a tune on his head, all the heads at the bar turn around at the exact same time and amplify that reaction. And it's just, I don't know. It's like, how can you not get on board with a movie like that?
And there's so many other these, and then going to the next scene, again, talking about the macabre humor in this, in the next following scene where the safe is dropped on Acme's head, and you see his little outline, you know, in the little body outline, and then the safe is right there, and the cop says, oh, just like a tune to drop a, you know, safe on the guy's head, and then realizing that Valiant is right next to him, and he you know, it's funny, but it's so dark.
To cast Bob Hoskins in this movie, can we talk about how great he is and how much fucking pathos he adds to Valiant and Valiant in this movie? Because I think a lot of why those scenes work, Brian, like the moment you mentioned a moment ago, like, sorry, Eddie, is he can just instantly turn on he can sort of turn on this a deep well of internal sadness, and he's called upon to do it several times in the film. That kind of grounds all of the interactions with Roger. So to talk about that for a second, Brian, like, yeah, we have talked about the kind of the cartoony influences of this film, but where is that well of sadness drawing from? Where is that noirish well of feelings that is so familiar to us coming from?
Well, from a lot of sources, to be honest. It's interesting. There's a lot of talk about Chinatown, and which is definitely included in the influence behind the music as well. In fact, you know, Jerry Goldsmith scored Chinatown, but he was not the original composer of Chinatown. There was actually another composer named Philip Lambro who had scored that film and worked, you know, a significant chunk of time on it. And in the end, Polanski threw it out, and there was so little time left that when Goldsmith came aboard, I think the famous story goes he had like 10 days to score that film.
Wow.
And there's no time, you know, there was no time to do anything particularly, I don't want to say the word clever, but there, you know, there's no time to experiment. There's no time. He just like, look, 10 days, I'm just going to lay down your quintessential film noir score. That's what this movie is. I'm just going to give it to you and move on. And it's funny, it's very much considered to be one of the last, you know, quote unquote film noir scores ever written. Because beyond that, you don't hear that type of music too much in movies anymore. And it was just out of sheer necessity, the lack of time. I mean, 10 days to compose it, and, you know, there's not that much music in it, but still 10 days is not a lot of time to write anything, much less a feature score. And it became one of the great quintessential film noir scores of all time. There's another score that always kind of resonated with me in relation to Roger Rabbit in almost a completely different way, but it comes to my mind. It's another score that I lecture about frequently, and that's Taxi Driver.
And
so in Taxi Driver, it's a character study. It's a psychological study of this, of the two halves of this one man, Travis Bickle, the taxi driver, played by Robert De Niro. And you have his dark, brooding, sadistic, you know, psychological side. And then you have his caring, I want to be normal, I want to have a girlfriend side. And Bernard Herrmann, the way he scored that film is that he really radically could turn that music onto a dime, just because that's kind of how he was. There was no transition from the dark music into the saxophone, the sultry saxophone. It just literally turned right on a dime. One measure, you'll be here. The next measure, okay, now we're going to change the music entirely. And he did that a lot in Taxi Driver. And because of that, it almost... Silvestri almost takes a similar approach here with Roger Rabbit. It almost gives him that license to kind of, we can change the music so quickly, especially coming out of this Carl Stalling, Mickey Mousing vibe too, where the music is constantly changing. So the fact that Carl Stalling's influence is involved almost allows this music to change quickly, because we're used to hearing that in cartoons. And so for him to go from, you know, very, even the score for Roger Rabbit is very lively and cartoony and plays tight to the action. But as soon as Jessica Rabbit comes on the screen, that music just changes on a dime. The sultry saxophone comes in. When Judge Doom appears, it changes on a dime. When Benny shows up, the music is really quick and lively and pumped up. And there's just so many different elements that involve. But that film noir definitely comes from many, many, many years of tradition. I mean, the saxophone is the quintessential damsel sound, where the woman, you know, shows up at the detective's office. And why fight that? You know, why go? I mean, if you're going for that vibe, if you're going for that sound, drive it home. And that's what he did.
Especially when you have something, you know, it's like you can't really go right for the center of it, especially when you have something so distant from it, like all the cartoony music that you're going to have to reconcile with. It's funny you mentioned Taxi Driver. I revisited it recently.
recently, and I was just reminded how much Travis Bickle in his costuming and everything represents, ironically, in within the film, because he's a psychopath, but a kind of earlier era, more wholesome. He thinks of himself in that way. He wants a girlfriend. He wants to take her out. He represents a kind of pre-1969, in his own mind, view of America that doesn't recognize this world around him. And in that way, that's why, and this is when we were watching him, so we really loved the Bernard Herrmann score, because the way in which it felt classic, it felt as if, oh, this is the worldview through which Travis Bickle sees the world. When you hear kind of really lush or romantic music and you're shooting through the front of his taxi cab, you really, it puts you inside of that world. And what's interesting is, as we jump between the kind of internal world of the tunes and the internal world of Eddie Valiant, like Eddie Valiant is all darkness and tragedy early on, and then deeper as he kind of comes to his spiritual awakening and he gives up booze and he gets out his cartoon gun and he heads into Toon Land. Finally, by the end of the movie, kind of his internal world becomes more populated by all of that cartoony music, and then it ends in a big song and dance number. So yes, that's what I'm saying, is that this movie and Taxi Driver are basically the same movie. That's what I'm saying.
I'm glad you see it too. Again, it's something I have always personally held a little bit of an association with, mostly because of the music and the characterization, but I've never heard anybody else echo that. It's always been just kind of like my little internalized.
Oh yeah. Well, it's cool. No, it is, especially with Taxi Driver. Yeah, it's written all over. It's written, now you realize, all over every little decision that Scorsese makes around that character. And I think it's written, you know, the same principle though is definitely at work here, because we, so every time we linger with Bob Hoskins and his great face, we are full early on with that music of that lets you know his soul is populated by nothing but melancholy and sadness. And then eventually it all bursts out in joy as he rediscovers the strength of his clown fathers, and their strength comes into him so he can vanquish Judge Doom. So speaking of harsh shit in this movie, remember the scene when Judge Doom boils the shoe? Did that fuck anyone else up when they were younger?
That's a terrifying scene. Boss.
That's right.
There's a number of those in this movie, and again, rewatching it recently, you know, you went, going back to Bob Hoskins real quick, you mentioned him. Mm-hmm. I noticed two things in my rewatch a few days ago. One was, yeah, the little subtle nuances in Hoskins' performance. Yeah, I've always known, wow, what a great performance. But I started to really focus in on his eye motion, you know, the way he tilted his head. You know, he has a lot of internalized performance in that in this film, which really makes it special. But then the other thing that, you know, leapt out at me was, yeah, there's some really, really dark moments in this movie. And I remember being freaked out by them. Some of the more obvious ones, I remember being freaked out by it when I was a kid and I was watching, like, wow, that's just really, you know, kind of freaky. But rewatching it again, it made me think, man, they just don't make movies like this anymore. Where, like, and again, yeah, that poor shoot. I mean, that's as graphic as an execution as you will ever see on film.
Yes, yes. And what I like about it is that that's what gives the film so much, not unlike the two different types of scoring, it's what gives the film so much internal life, is you have these really big dynamics between moments that are legitimately terrifying and then literal cartoons happening at the beginning of the film. And yeah, that's to finally, that brings us to Christopher Lloyd, who... you know, we now kind of, it's funny with given the podcast that we've been doing, we kind of see this as now the third performance in a trilogy of sorts, because he gives us Doc Brown, he gives us The Light Side, and then in between, wasn't it in between, Richard, that he did Amazing Stories? Yeah, so he did this Amazing Stories episode with that Robert Zemeckis directed, where he plays an evil professor, and he almost looks like he's kind of the midpoint between Judge Doom and he plays an evil teacher. What was his name? Mr. Beans. He has big black hair and he's evil and he runs around without a head. It's a rad episode of Amazing Stories. Check it out. But then now he goes full darkness in this, and he is just he's sort of this weird he's a mixture between like the Wicked Witch of the West and like John Huston from Chinatown is basically what he looks like. So
With this weird makeup line that I noticed for the first time, and his teeth, which are obviously fake, and just I never noticed them before. Yes. They look so unnatural.
And the weird pointed
nose
and pointed chin and all of the stuff. Yeah,
the hook nose is like a vulture.
It's funny because you think, you know, early, I remember this when I watched it when I was a kid. I mean, you think that's just a character trait of his vainness, you know, that he's just old and trying to make himself look you know, statelier and more regal than he truly is. But and then you realize, well, there, mm-hmm. that could be true, but there's also the other meaning as well, which is
yes, exactly. No, I dig it. So Judge Doom was introduced as this evil figure who's going around and he's running Toontown. It adds this dark thread to the movie. We're like, so Toontown is like being policed by a weird guy who's randomly executing cartoon characters. This is a different world. And then we learn that Judge Doom is slowly taken over by spreading simoleons, obviously Toontown money, around. And we also, of course, find out that Bob Hoskins' brother was killed by a toon who got away after stealing a zillion simoleons. And not unlike great detective stories, we find out that in this film, three or four different stories all lead back to one story. And in the end, we find out, of course, that Judge Doom is the one that dropped a safe on Valiant's brother. And he is, in fact, a toon. And we, again, get that in... To kind of skip ahead a bit to Judge Doom's demise, we get that in one of the a surprisingly dark and violent sequence, which you can tell they edited as quickly as they could when he gets steamrolled. Yeah. He's hopping up like seconds later before they even have time to react, because like kids can't have a flat guy for too long. It would clearly terrify them. But Judge Doom gets steamrolled, revealed to be a big bad evil cartoon, and then Bob Hoskins has to finally sort of complete his journey and defeat him with laughter. In the end, kill him with laughter. But Christopher Lloyd's performance throughout this whole fucking movie is so arch and so big and so, I don't know, so good. He is terrifying in this fucking film and hilarious.
That line, remember me, Eddie, when I killed your brother, I talked just like this. That terrified me as a child.
It freaked me out. It still does.
Rewatching it for this, he's almost got an Elmer Fudd quality to him too. He's chasing a rabbit the entire time, and maybe it was I was high. That's and when he walks into the bar, the way he kind of mumbles his line, "I'm looking for a murderer." That's how he says that line. It's almost like he's almost dropping the R's in rabbit. Later in that scene.
Yeah, it's very Fudd. That's a good point. That's a good point. He has a very, it's evil Elmer Fudd chasing a rabbit. Yeah.
And I don't remember seeing Elmer Fudd in the movie either. So that's my theory.
Brian, quick question. Where does this score, do you think, rank in the rest of the filmography of Alan Silvestri? Because I want to just touch on some other things briefly while we have you here, because, you know, we talk a lot about Robert Zemeckis on this movie, on this podcast, but we don't touch on Alan Silvestri as much as we should. So, just broadly, what are some of your favorite Silvestri scores from the Zemeckis filmography?
I mean, that's a tough question because obviously I like them all for different reasons. But there's something, again, one of the reasons I wanted to come on to talk about Who Framed Roger Rabbit is because there's something, there's a technical level of skill here that from a composer's perspective is very impressive. Now, does that mean I listen to Who Framed Roger Rabbit more than other scores? No, I probably listen to Back to the Future and Forrest Gump and some of his other bigger ones. I probably listen to those a whole lot more than I would Roger Rabbit. But there's a technical skill that, again, if you're a composer and you're getting what he's trying to do and what he's accomplishing, it's just, you're just kind of like wowed by it. Now, for the casual, you know, cinema goer, it just sounds like fun, great music, which it also is. But I would always put Roger Rabbit up there. So what else has he done? I mean, Romancing the Stone is weird. I mean, I don't know how many people really listen to the score for Romancing the Stone. It's actually a very weird score, but because of that, I love it too. It's so, you know, if Romancing the Stone is kind of his, you know, a poor man's Raiders of the Lost Ark, which I think it kind of has a lot of that vibe to it. The score certainly isn't. The score couldn't be more radically different. It's more of a pop synthy score, which not what you would expect to hear in a film like that. So, but that's one of the reasons that endears that film to me. Yeah. And that was their first. So, you know, that kind of set them on their path to where they are today. So,
Rad. Yeah, that's another film that has to, again, bridge. And I think that that maybe is part of the magic of Alan Silvestri, is that ability to reconcile and bridge some of these really disparate cinematic spaces with music, just because in that film you have full-blown adventure, then mixing with just kind of a very contemporary 80s kind of a synth pop score, and then it all sort of somehow comes back together and makes sense. And you kind of see a really cool and I'll just say an even bigger, higher budget kind of version of that with Roger Rabbit. So with all of the cartoon shit. But Richard, what?
Let me say something real quick, because one of the things Silvestri has said about the Roger Rabbit score that I read is the greatest compliment I can ever receive is that the score is appropriate.
That's great.
Which I think, especially in this context, is apt. Very mm-hmm. apt.
And let me mention two other things about Silvestri in relation to Zemeckis. There are two other films that really stand out to me, but again, in completely different ways. And the first one I want to mention is Castaway. Most people know this by now, but I remember watching it for the very first time and realizing this, and I still like to point it out to people. The first note of music does not come into the picture until, like, I think it's like an hour and 36 minutes into the film. Oh, wow. Or something like that. You guys are probably... I don't know if you've talked about Castaway yet on your podcast.
We're going chronological, so we are getting there slowly. But we have intentionally not revisited any of these lately.
But just to
give us the primer.
Give you something to talk about. Do you know when that first note of music? I mean, there's literally not a single note of score from the opening frame until what moment? Do you know the moment?
Oh, fuck no. But you tell me, Brian, or should we wait
it's
for
when
it?
It's when the ship, he's like cresting the wave, right?
It's when he finally builds his little makeshift boat, and he finally gets over the wave and enters calm water. That nice. The oboe comes in, and that's like an hour and 40 some odd minutes into the picture, and, yep. and that's when you get your very first note of music. And that, you talk about the functionality of music. Could earlier moments of that film have benefited from some music? I think there are some scenes that could have used it, but by purposefully withholding it. When he gets off that island and you hear music for the very first time after like an hour and 40 minutes, it is such this overwhelming feeling of relief, emotional mm-hmm. relief. And it totally mm-hmm. like, you could tell they were just sitting back saying, hey, let's just keep the music out until this very moment. And that's going to make that moment just really, really mm-hmm. pop. So that's yeah. and there's only like, that's like a 2 hour some odd minute film. I think there's only like 12 minutes of music or 16 mm-hmm. the whole movie, because it only takes place at the end. I think there's like four yeah. cues.
Just saying, speaking of just, I was going to bring it back just momentarily to Roger Rabbit, in that same kind of relief, what I like about the end of Roger Rabbit and why Bob Hoskins sort of defeating Judge Doom with music and with a big song and dance number is so wonderful is in this film that has kind of tended in this balance towards cartooniness and darkness the whole time, where we've seen some dark moments. We've mentioned The Shoe and some other things. It's like they could have gone for a tenser, darker, more action-y kind of ending that lived in a darker tonal space, because generally that's where a lot of films sort of trend. They sort of get darker and darker and more serious until the villains are defeated. Mm-hmm. But what I like is that, you know, to complete Bob Hoskins' arc, to complete where his character is going, the fact that he has to defeat them with laughter requires that the kind of movie ultimately settles on and lives in and kind of takes on as its identity the cartoony music, and the cartoony music kind of wins the battle between the kind of between the Chinatown score and and all of the cartoony music at the end. And Bob Hoskins, just as he kind of learns, or just as he figures out that there's a great power that he can draw from learning to love tunes again and learning to remember what he and his brother had to get. So it completes that arc. I don't know. I just that ending is more and more powerful as I get back to it.
And, it's especially because he ramps up the Judge Doom music mm-hmm. there at the end. He's got his own little theme, his own little mm-hmm. musical flavor, and it's fairly subtle and dark. But when he that finale, I mean, Silvestri's just driving. It's almost like the Imperial yes. March. You know, she's just driving mm-hmm. this Judge Doom music. And so when he counters that with the cartoony victory, it's beautiful. You're right.
Well, Brian, any closing thoughts on Alan Silvestri, on Roger Rabbit, on any of that kind of stuff?
Yep. The only other thing I want to say is that I think probably one of my favorite scores that Silvestri did to a Zemeckis film is from Polar Express. Mm-hmm. And you know, it is, it, I consider it to be probably the greatest Christmas score ever written. It's one of those, like, every Christmas rolls around, that's the score that I have to listen to like put me mm-hmm. in. I did my radio show, Film Score Focus. I did a radio show for 14 years, and I did a yearly Christmas episode, and I always changed out all mm-hmm. the scores. But every year, my tradition was I ended the show with the big epic suite from Polar Express. And it's just a great example of how chameleon-like Silvestri can be to Zemeckis' movies. I mean, because you span all of his music over all of Zemeckis' films, and it's just amazing the different musical styles and flavors that he was able to execute. And then Roger Rabbit, he did it all, did a lot in just one movie. And again, that'll continue to impress me forever, just the way that he was able to manage all that and make it a cohesive. I mean, when you listen to the score for Roger Rabbit, it sounds like one score. It doesn't sound like 40, you know, chopped up. It sounds like a cohesive single breath of music, but yet there's just so much behind it.
One of the things I thought I was hearing, Brian, and maybe you can say something about this, is it felt like the cartoon instrumentation and the performance style was bleeding into all the noir stuff. And that was one thing that felt like it bridged it for me. Is that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, definitely. Cause he's taking all these styles and then he's taking the seams and just kind of blending over them. You're right. They're not, that's why it doesn't sound like 40 chopped up individual, you know, if Zemeckis was going to try to cut in, you know, edit in pre-existing music to, you know, he could have done that theoretically to make all those parts sound individually correct. But then it's going to sound like 40 individual pieces of music just chopped up in there. But the way Silvestri he just makes it seamless and everything, these 2, 3, 4 disparate flavors of music just sound like this single idea. That's incredibly difficult to do.
Mm-hmm. And I think that the effect of that is that instead of having all those different pieces, the cumulative effect is that the film begins to take on its own kind of internal life, its own mm-hmm. feeling tone, its own identity. And that in itself makes all of those pieces feel integrated in a way that, yeah, sure, if they had, you know, a cartoony bit that they had pulled for the cartoon bits and they had dropped in some, you know, film noir needle drops for the film noir sections, they would have worked individually, but the film, I don't think, would feel like it had a coherent center or a coherent whole, a coherent world in the way that it does, thanks to the fact that the score actually integrates all of those pieces. And I think that's just that cumulative effect of it all being original and it all being integrated, as opposed to just a bunch of disparate elements that are bookended against each other. So,
yeah. And sadly, I mean, that quality is kind of dying in modern film music, mm-hmm. where temp music is becoming, you know, kind of reigning the roost, that, you know, when directors cut in temporary selections and then the composer's job is not to compose a score, but to make those temporary selections legal. I think modern film music has a lot more of that chopped up, non-cohesive kind of a vibe to it. Whereas, great. I mean, I think one of the best examples is Roger Rabbit, where you can just have all these different flavors and then just make them seamless. It's mm-hmm. fantastic work.
I do want to apologize to you, Brian, for asking you to do a spoof on both Back to the Future and Forrest Gump for our intro music. I know we've talked about this temp music so much, and the task that we come to you is please do a play on these two pieces, please.
Yes. But that's different. That's different. You have a Zemeckis podcast, and you're doing an homage to his musical sound.
Exactly. That's
a completely different situation. Yeah, I totally. I was thrilled. I mean, that's a great exercise. I mean, I love that, you know. But if I'll tell you this, if you when you go out and you make your next film and you do that, I might say something about that. But
thank you, Brian, for that.
Yeah, it was fun. I enjoyed it.
It has given a coherent soul, a center, if you will, to this podcast.
Because Lord knows it needs one.
Yes.
I want to ask you guys, do you have a moment where in the film that really stands out to you, where you really feel like the animation is truly there on screen with them? Is there a moment that, like, it just seems like, wow, that is actually happening? I have a couple.
Oh, you hit me with yours and it'll give me a chance to think for a second, because I know they exist.
It's kind of a subtle moment. It's kind of a subtle moment for me, but it's the scene where he pulls out the cartoon gun and then asks the bullets to get into the gun. Mm-hmm. And the way that he, you know, like every time a bullet goes into the gun, his hand shakes, you know, and mm-hmm. gun feels like it has weight. The bullets going into the gun feels like they're causing, I mean, it's a subtle moment, but every time I see that, it's like, they really found a cartoon gun and cartoon mm-hmm. bullets and they just filmed it. It's an amazing moment where I just think that the animation and the live action is just utter perfection. Mm-hmm.
I think that definitely the speakeasy, there's something about the back room, and I know that there were a lot of animation challenges that Zemeckis threw at them, like having the light swing around in there, which causes yeah. all these shadows. But there's something about that speakeasy room because Roger is constantly interacting with like a nail file, the handcuffs, rattling a crate, and the lighting is so bizarre and shadowy that makes him feel grounded there in that space, even though they literally would animate those shadows onto Roger. There's something about that room where I can remember even being a kid and just feeling fully like it was just three characters hanging out in a back room and one of them happened to be a cartoon character. Like all the stuff where he puts his hand through the handcuffs and the handcuffs tumble down. I think I still in my mind, I have to stop and remind myself that, oh, right, that was like, probably hanging from a string and then they dropped it and they put a rabbit in later, because in my mind I just buy it as physics. So
the two for me are there's some of it in his office where Roger is throwing him across the room in the handcuffs like, and that happens in the back room too, where he realizes there's a peephole and all of a sudden Bob Hoskins and Dolores are thrown into a pile of boxes where just the mm-hmm. you can feel him pulling them. So those are, that's one for me. And the other is the shot. Which I've always, like, I didn't realize how imprinted that moment was on me, but man, watching that, it's Roger's performance, like, the guy who's yeah. voicing Roger is so good. The animation is so good. The back and forth with the water sloshing. And even the thing I noticed this time is Christopher Lloyd is even moving his wrists. So you mm-hmm. have, like, there's a billion elements right there. Yeah. And also it's this big tense moment. Is he going to die? Mm-hmm. So those are the two for me.
Yeah, no, Brad. Oh, it works.
It definitely works.
It works as a movie.
Can I say too, there's one small image, and this has nothing to do with the interaction, but just thinking back on my history of drinking, when Roger has that first shot in R.K. Maroon's office and goes through all of the different faces, that one where he's purple and just goes, ah, you know, that one. That has stuck with me so strongly. Just that one, like, it's like,
well, it's
half
because
a second.
Roger Rabbit, Richard.
I guess we've established this. I probably am.
That's it, man. Brian, where can people find you?
So let me think. Where can people find me? Yeah. So I'm on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram at BM Satter.
Cool. Message us. We'll get you in contact. Oh, and do you want to mention your book, Brian?
So the project that I'm been working on now for a while is I'm writing my first book. It's called The Music of Friday the 13th. I'm a tremendous Friday the 13th fan, and I love the series and the music. And I've spent a year working on it right now. It's about probably a little over halfway done. It should probably be coming out early 2021, maybe. But it's a comprehensive book on the music for all 12 movies, the video games, documentaries, you name it. Anything Friday the 13th related that has music in it, I'm writing about it.
Killer. Fantastic. We're talking a little bit about it before the podcast started. It sounds really, really cool, and we're looking forward to it as a big Friday the 13th fan myself, and as a big fan of Brian Satterwhite. Brian, thank you for coming on Bob Zemeckis Is Not a Butthead. You know, we loved having you on.
You guys are among my favorite people to talk to movies about or talk with, so yeah, anytime.
Stop talking about us behind our backs, Brian.
Yeah, I will.
So glad we had Brian on. I had never heard of this Mickey Mousing thing.
Yes.
I love that idea.
Well, I'm with Brian on because Brian actually has, you know, talents and skills and things we don't have. He can talk about shit for real. That's yeah. right. And we just make shit up.
He knows what radio is. He's had a radio show for forever. I felt like I was a dummy. But you know what? Whatever.
He's a broadcast professional. I'm
I'm finally glad that yes, that Mickey Mousing has entered my personal lexicon, which weirdly it's a useful term because I think we all distinctly remember watching like Wile E. Coyote cartoons, mm-hmm. and like he picks up sand and lets it fall through his hands and you hear like a xylophone go with the sand. Just like that's a whole different way for music to work, where you're just making sound effects for your cartoons with xylophones and shit. And I'm just glad that I now know that term. Thank you, Brian. And now this is officially an educational podcast, so we should get some sort of tax break, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Or this episode should cost less than $9.99 an episode.
That's right. It's only $9.99, people, all right?
The Mickey Mousing thing, just thinking about it right now, thinking about some of the things that the Looney Tunes did, where they were taking mm-hmm. a big piece of classical music and almost animating to Mickey, like reverse Mickey Mousing to that old piece of music. What's that one with Brumhilda and like, I think it's Porky Pig and do you know what I'm talking about?
It's a lot of it's, oh no, 100%. Yeah. The whole like Wagner opera one. What is it called? Right. Holy crap.
Or the Rabbit of Seville was one.
Oh yeah. No, Rabbit of Seville. That's Racine. Yeah. And that like that stuff, yes, that's a good way of putting it. The reverse Mickey Mouse is burned deeply, deeply, deeply into my brain watching Bugs Bunny, you know, one eyebrow raised to Rossini. And like he's doing the like massaging the scalp of
with his hands and Elmer Fudd,
and then yes with his hands and then his feet, and then he what is it, he does the clay into the cube and breaks it, and Daisy grows out of his head and all of that stuff, and that stuff is just, you know, is just baked the fuck in there now. And I think that's probably, I mean, I know for a fact that is actually where my appreciation of classical music started, which to bring things full circle is kind of how we met Brian, was listening to his radio show on the classical station, which I fully remember some of the first classical recordings I bought were a Rossini recording specifically for The Rabbit of Seville or The Rabbit of Seville, and specifically buying also, one of the other ones that I know I pulled from Looney Tunes for another day. I'll remember it another time. So in an indirect way, Richard, this Mickey Mousing brought us to Brian and now has brought all of this useful information to all of our listeners. And that's magic.
And if anybody, like Brian wants to do this Mickey Mousing thing. So if there are any filmmakers listening that want to throw Brian a big challenge.
Yes, I know.
Please.
Brian is a very talented. No, well, Brian, and this is another note, if you're in the Dallas area, I think he periodically does these, he travels down there to do, you know, he'll do like scores. I think a lot of people do versions of this, but I think he does it with a fairly large orchestra. Will do scores for, you know, Metropolis or, you know, many silent film, kind of the silent film Usual Suspects, if you will. A lot of Fritz Lang.
I've never seen one of those. I wish I could have gone.
I know. I want to go down there and do one of those. So yeah, I've seen live scores plenty in Austin. I just now have not seen Brian do one yet, but that is a rad experience. So
yeah, good to have him on. Hope we can have him on again.
For sure.
And then I think next episode is Back to the Future 2.
Yes, Back to the Future 2. I'm very excited about that. So we'll jump right back in with talking about Doc Brown and all of Marty McFly's edible insecurities. Right back at it.
I thought you said edible insecurities, like he was
eating. Yeah, because he takes like he's like a 10-milligram guy, but in Back to the Future 2, he's like, I'm going 20 milligrams, so he has like two gummies and he is floating, brah, floating. So
maybe that's where we should end this. So
that feels the most appropriate note on which to end this.
So as usual, I'm at Bob Zemeckis on Instagram. That's where
you are. And we really have to continue to emphasize that Richard is now at Bob Zemeckis on Instagram.
It's
officially
true. And please follow. I spend way too much time doing really, really poor Photoshops of the posters.
And again, we cannot emphasize how poor the Photoshop jobs are, but again,
Oh, and it's an emergency. Kyle spilled something.
So cool. I just knocked over my coffee. All right.
Later, buttheads.
Later.